Coming up today, how could TJ Maxx end up sponsoring library books and materials designed to teach children about transgender ideology? Will Hild of Consumers Research will explain.
Effectively, DEI departments exist to make whatever corporation they're inside of a arm of the progressive left democratic coalition. And a big part of that is pushing LGBTQ propaganda, which is what we see here.
Then we'll continue our pro-life theme this month with a discussion of the technological wonders and moral risks of in vitro fertilization. Ed Vitagliano will join us.
If life begins at conception, which is clearly what Christians should believe, then destroying these unused embryos is no different than aborting an unborn child.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. Well, thank you for joining us for another look at what is going on in culture, faith, and family. We wanted to start off today's program with something that won't make the national headlines, but is nevertheless affecting thousands of school children across the country. It is called the Rainbow Library, and it's bringing something into the hearts and minds of children that no sane person would want there: transgender ideology. And what is even more, you'll be surprised at the company that's making this happen. With me is Will Hild. He's the executive director of Consumers Research, founded in 1929 with the mission to educate and protect consumers from harmful products. They're heading up an effort to warn parents about this and also to give them ways to do something about it. Mr. Hild, welcome to The Stand Radio.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Will, tell us, first of all, what is the Rainbow Library Project and who is making it happen?
Certainly. Well, the Rainbow Library Project is an attempt to push radical LGBTQ propaganda into public schools in the hands of children across the country. It's supported by a group called GLSEN, which is called the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. And that's their entire mission, is to basically push this type of propaganda into schools. Now, as far as who's behind it, there's a second layer of that answer, which is why we're on talking about today, which is they have a corporate sponsor of TJ Maxx, which is fairly surprising given the activities that the Rainbow Library is focused on.
What is the age target of this project?
It varies, but I've seen it as young as 5 years old, which is really when kids start going to pre-kindergarten or kindergarten. So really, basically, as soon as they are away from parents for a moment, these folks are trying to slip this stuff into their hands.
Wow. Describe a little bit about what is in the Rainbow Library. So if a child comes across this, what are they going to be exposed to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I actually brought up the websites, the library itself, just so I could read off some of these titles. For what, you know, The Lesbian's Guide to Catholic School, Beyond the Gender Binary. And then a number of these titles seem innocuous, which is part of their strategy, but actually are usually an allegory for some sort of, you know, sexual preference or lifestyle that they're trying to push. So things like Timid or Cinder Elliot, A Scrumptious Fairy Tale, which is clearly a transgender allegory. So this is a common strategy where some of the books are explicit in what they are pushing. Some of them are not explicit, so that a parent or teacher picked one up, they wouldn't realize what they were reading maybe until they got into it.
Now, I understand that there are lesson plans that are actually being included with this material to give the teacher some direction on how to introduce these concepts into their education program.
Yes, that's right. And this kind of feeds into something that, Twitter accounts like Libs of TikTok have picked up on, which is in a number of public schools and maybe even in some private schools, you've got teachers who are complicit in trying to indoctrinate children with this kind of far left radical gender ideology. And so the GLSEN Library, in addition to pushing this stuff into libraries, also works with teachers who might, you know, have that as a shared goal, even if the parents obviously may not share that same position.
Now, how did you get word that TJ Maxx was making this happen, was actually supplying financial support?
Well, this is something that we try to monitor as much as possible. We recently, a couple years ago, got whistleblower information that the company State Farm was actually pushing this kind of nonsense, not through GLSEN, but through another organization called the Gender Cool Project. And so it clued us in that this is a common tactic that these activists use, and that they pair with friends, I would say at least friends inside of these corporations, if not friendly corporations themselves, basically to have this stuff paid for by corporate America. So it's something that we monitor. We certainly, there's probably instances of it we haven't found, but it's something that we try to keep an eye out for, and that's what happened here.
Yeah, that's very good. We should mention that TJ Maxx also owns retail stores like Home Goods, Marshalls, and others. Tell us why a company that deals in clothing and merchandise like that has any interest in promoting transgender ideology. What's the connection here between the corporate and the ideology?
Certainly. Well, the short answer is very simple. It's called DEI. Corporations have been pressured through government action and also activist groups like the Human Rights Campaign to grow and enlarge their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Okay. And these things are, I would say, just cancerous, both in the pejorative sense of the word, and meaning they're evil and wrong, but also in the technical sense. DEI doesn't actually contribute to the bottom line of a corporation. It doesn't help it return value to shareholders. And more importantly, it doesn't help it provide value to its customers. What it exists to do is to grow larger, to expand itself, and to grow more and more dominion over the operations of the company to push it in a far left direction. Effectively, DEI departments exist to make whatever corporation they're inside of a arm of the progressive left Democratic coalition. And a big part of that is pushing LGBTQ propaganda, which is what we see here. So usually what happens is within one of these DEI departments, somebody who's tasked with LGBTQ outreach will suggest to the company, or even do so without, you know, informing the higher up executives, that they're going to sponsor one of these activities. And because there's sort of a general policy of corporate America of trying to do outreach to all of these communities, the corporate executives don't really look at it that closely. That's what we saw with State Farm. The CEO, at least if we're going to take his word for it, claimed he wasn't aware that his company was pushing this nonsense to kids as young as five. And so that's sort of what happens. You have basically radical activists who have snuck into the company via DEI pushing this stuff and putting their corporate names and money behind stuff that is, you know, extremely offensive to basically most of the country.
Yeah, what you've described is happening all over the place, sadly. We should mention that American Family News has reached out to TJ Maxx and, as of the date of this recording, has not heard anything back from them. Will, how many schools are being influenced by the Rainbow Library and all of the books and curriculum that they're producing?
You know, it's hard to say the exact number because some of this stuff is happening intentionally, you know, without alerting the general public. But on the GLSEN website, they brag that over 5,800 schools have received materials from the GLSEN library, a total of 58,000 books. So this is a pretty broad problem. And I think people sometimes have an understanding that, hey, this stuff just happens in, you know, states like New York or California. But because, like I said, of the involvement of a number of, you know, school teachers in public schools that feel that it's their job or their responsibility to push this stuff, you have stuff like this going on in every state in the country. So if you've got a kid in public schools, you should be on the lookout for this kind of thing.
Okay, I know parents are listening and they're wondering, what in the world can I do? Your company, Consumers Research, provides a means for them to take action. Would you tell us about that?
That's exactly right. We have something called Woke Alerts, and in fact, we put out a Woke Alert on this very thing. And that is a text message-based alert system. We promise we won't bombard you with spam, which usually about once a week we send one out. You can sign up at our website at consumersresearch.org. That's consumersresearch.org. Basically, once a week, we send out a Woke Alert to consumers about companies that are doing things like, you know, sponsoring the GLSEN library, targeting children. Sometimes it varies what the company is up to. But I want to make this clear. The point of the Woke Alert isn't just to make you, you know, impotently angry. We don't want to just gin up frustration or fatalism. The idea is to help people activate and push back on these companies. I think sometimes conservatives often undervalue how important their voice is when pushing back on these companies. They tend to think about their wallet. You know, I'm not going to spend money at this company anymore. And that's important too. And we always support consumers putting their money where their values are. But I think that I would strongly recommend that people use their voice as well, because sometimes calls and emails to these companies matters even more than changing shopping habits. And so we always include contact information in all of our Woke Alerts. So whether it's an email or a phone number or both, however best to reach the company, we want people to feel like they can push back, call these companies, tell them that you don't approve what they're doing, that it's going to affect where you spend your dollars. And that's what changes these companies' minds and helps them to really focus on making sure that this kind of stuff doesn't happen in their company again.
Yeah, well said. Folks, you need to get the woke alerts from Consumers Research, and you can get that by going to their website, and we'll mention that, consumersresearch.org. Consumersresearch.org. We'll put a link to that on our podcast page. Will, thank you so much for what you're doing. And like you said, it's not enough simply not to shop somewhere. You need to let people know that you're aware of what's going on and that you don't approve of that and that it's plain wrong. So, Will, thank you for that. And thank you for your work. Tell us a little bit about Consumers Research. You've been around since 1929. That's a long time. Tell us a little bit about your organization.
That's right. We were founded as the first real product review organization in the country. Our founder had written a book called 100 Million Guinea Pigs because that was the population of the United States at the time. And he was recognizing that companies were just dumping products on the market without safety testing them or testing for their efficacy. And so that's really where our pedigree comes from. We've got a 90-year history of protecting consumers in the marketplace and amplifying their voice as well. And that's something that I've focused on. I came on as the executive director 5 years ago. And really our main focus, probably 90% of our time, is pushing back against this woke capitalism poison that, in addition to doing horrible things, you know, targeting children like what we've talked about today, it takes the focus of the corporation away from serving you, the consumer, and onto serving the Democratic Party or a progressive political platform. It focuses internally on politics and not externally on you, the consumer. So even if you don't care about anything you've heard today, even if you don't have kids or this isn't your issue, you should care about it because companies like TJ Maxx are spending their time and energy focusing on this and not giving you high quality goods at the lowest possible prices. And that's something we're pushing back on every day at Consumers Research.
Very good. Consumers Research at consumersresearch.org. Will Hild, Executive Director, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as technology increases, so do the moral challenges that emerge alongside. Christians have always depended on Scripture as a guide when it comes to ethical decisions, and new technologies, especially reproductive technologies, offer plenty of opportunity to seek the Lord's wisdom. AFA Executive Vice President Ed Vitagliano is with us to talk about his latest article in the Stand magazine that addresses the moral challenges of in vitro fertilization. It's titled, Should Christian Couples Use IVF? Ed, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Jeff.
If you would describe the process to begin with of in vitro fertilization and how it's being used today.
Yeah, this is not an area that I have any expertise in. So as we were putting together a pro-life issue of the Stand magazine, I wanted to take a look at some of the complications that have arisen from this topic of in vitro fertilization, referred to commonly as IVF. I did not know it had been around since 1978. That's the first time, at least, that it was feasible in this country. So from a layman's perspective here, I'm not a scientist for any note, IVF is the process by which medical science can artificially create fertilized embryos outside the womb.
Okay,
so you artificially fertilize them, then you can implant the embryo into the womb, and people who can't have children, who are otherwise infertile, can have the opportunity to have children. So that's the simplest way possible to describe this process, which I couldn't describe in any kind of scientifically exact way.
It's sort of like we used to call it back in the, you know, the 80s, 70s and 80s, test tube babies. That was the phrase that was used back in, back in those times.
And it gives the impression that you're creating it in a test tube.
Yeah.
And I guess there may be some technical ways in which that's accurate, but that's the kind of general idea.
It's highly advanced technology. How has this technology changed today to give us the kind of dilemmas that we're facing?
You know, as I began to do some research on this, I did not realize the technological changes that have occurred over 40 years since 1978. The technological changes are going to really challenge the church, broadly speaking, with wrestling with the theological implications. Because as I began to do research, I discovered that it is possible to fertilize a woman's egg by the genetic editing of female stem cells.
Okay.
Okay, so that you would not even need a, let me put it as vaguely as possible, you would not need a male's input into the process. Had no idea we were at that place technologically. Technicians will soon be able to create the sperm and the ovum using stem cells. Artificial wombs for gestation so that a woman would not necessarily even have to carry a baby. There would be an artificial womb, and then the baby is at the age when you would normally have labor and delivery. And then there is the technological possibilities of children created from the use of DNA from several quote-unquote parents. So you could have technically what they call three-parent embryos. All of that stuff, as I began to do research for this feature story, I thought, that sounds like science fiction.
Yeah.
It's not fictional.
Yeah. The more you describe that, you're thinking, how many other variables can you throw into the equation?
Yes.
When you're talking about not even needing a human womb.
Yes.
That's
Yeah. So Christians are going to have to figure that out. You know, what if a woman has a damaged, you know, womb or is otherwise physically incapable of carrying a baby, but she wants a baby, her and her husband want a baby. Is it moral to consider a artificial womb? These are questions that Christians are going to have to wrestle with and try to come to some sort of theological understanding of what God's will is.
I know one of the main arguments in all of this, Ed, is the number of embryos that are created. And in your article, you do address that. And I think that may be a sort of a baseline that Christians can agree on, is that embryos should not be destroyed in the process of in vitro fertilization. Is that correct?
Yeah. And you know, the if I was to boil down all the different approaches to in vitro fertilization, it seemed like there are two main questions. First, is IVF wrong on its face? Okay. It's, in other words, there are those, it is just wrong. It's unnatural.
Yeah.
Human beings are supposed to, you know, conceive through sex, and that's within marriage. So IVF is wrong on its face. Others are taking the approach that it is the unregulated consequences of IVF that is wrong. And so if you can fix those consequences, then you can proceed with in vitro fertilization. And the issue you just raised, that kind of the death toll, is one of the primary arguments against IVF as I was doing the research. So typically when an infertile couple wants to have a baby, you create multiple fertilized embryos. You create them because you don't want to go through the process over and over and over again. You go through the process once of fertilizing all these embryos, and then you can implant them, and if something goes wrong, you can try again. All right. So the question arises, the issue arises, not just a question. Yeah. This is not just abstract. This is part of what people discuss. Once the woman gets pregnant, what if the couple no longer wants any more children? So if they don't want any more children, they have one, what happens to the quote-unquote leftover embryos? If life begins at conception, which is clearly what Christians should believe, then destroying these unused embryos is no different than aborting an unborn child. And the way those who oppose IVF explain it, it's even worse than that because you're actually creating several human lives to gain the single life that then gestates inside the mother. So it's multiple murders. So you can see where people would wrestle with this. And the number that I found in trying to figure out in America how many embryos are created every year for IVF, Emma Waters, who works at the Heritage Foundation on life, religion, and family life, she estimates, and she says it's a conservative estimate, that over 4 million embryos are created each year for the purpose of IVF. Now, obviously, those aren't all created by Christians, mm-hmm. but you can see we're dealing with huge numbers. What percentage of those are tossed in the dumpster? So this issue becomes really important for Christians. And those who are in favor of IVF, they're saying, well, there are ministries, there are clinics which take a pro-life approach to this, and they say couples can create only the number of fertilized embryos that they're going to use, and then others can be adopted so that lives are not lost. So that becomes the argument that Christians are having over the process when you consider death toll as one of the consequences of this process. There are other arguments that are had, but this is probably the main and the basic point of contention.
Yeah. Wow. Obviously, the Bible is our guide for believers in determining the morality of any issue. There are well-respected theologians who have strong commitments to the authority of Scripture who have opposing views on IVF. In your research, Ed, describe the range of opinions between people who respect the authority of Scripture would take different sides of this issue.
Yeah, I found two theologians that I personally have a lot of respect for. I've turned to them on other issues, even outside the issue of life and the sanctity of human life. Opposed to IVF was Carl Truman, and I used him to kind of be the individual speaking for that opposing side. He's a professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College. In favor of IVF is Wayne Grudem, who's a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary. These are two individuals that I've always had a lot of respect for. These are well-grounded individuals, Christian theology. They come down on opposite sides of this. Wayne Grudem takes what he considers a more pastoral approach, citing the women in the Bible who the Bible calls barren, can't have children, and the mercy that God shows them in having and giving them the ability to open their womb.
Right.
Whereas Carl Truman would say, okay, that's a divine intervention. Human beings should avoid trying to create that artificially. So there's a lot of back and forth. The Catholic Church is very strong on the issue of IVF. I think last year Pope Francis said that IVF was basically child trafficking because you're creating these embryos and you're farming them out, you know. And yes, a couple may use one, but then they may, you know, give or have others adopt them. And so the Pope says that's trafficking in children. So you can see the complexity of this mushrooms. And within the Christian community, there are a lot of different opinions.
Let's sort of shift our discussion to the church and how we wrestle with this issue. We are all in agreement that we need to be going to the Word of God for enlightenment. We know that God has put us in this time and in this place to seek Him. Therefore, there is wisdom to be found.
Right.
And so we can approach it with faith in that regard. As a pastor and as an elder, is this an issue that needs to be addressed at this point? Or is this something that you need to let play out for a ways and to find out what the arguments actually are? What would your recommendation be?
Yes, I do want to qualify that I am rotated off as an elder. So
okay, all
yeah.
Right.
So a small point, but I do want to try to maintain some accuracy there.
Okay.
I think we're going to be forced to wrestle with this.
Okay.
I'm not sure the answer is clear enough scripturally to take a hard stance. Now, people may come to a definite conclusion according to their conscience. But I think as long as some of the clearly unbiblical consequences of IVF, like I don't think it's permissible to throw out in a dumpster fertilized embryos. I mean, if you're pro-life, that is the consistent pro-life position.
Because you believe life begins at conception.
Life begins at conception.
Yeah.
Now, can Christians avoid some of those consequences and then proceed? I think there is room for Christians to agree and disagree on that. And I think that Christians are going to have to give other Christians space. It sounds funny to call this a conscience issue, because generally we use that for discussions about whether someone can have an alcoholic beverage, you know, with their Sunday afternoon meal. And I'm not discounting the importance of that discussion, but this is, for some people, we're talking about murder.
Sure.
And other people saying, no, it's not murder. These are couples that desperately want children. They are not treating these fertilized embryos as something to be tossed out. They desperately want children because they believe in the sanctity of human life. There's going to have to be some room for people to work their way through this, mm-hmm. and we're going to have charity towards one another. And so I'm not sure that that will happen right away, but we're going to have to be allowed to wrestle with this issue because the technology is changing so rapidly.
And in per your article, we need to allow some grace in those conversations when we interact with others.
Yes, and that's going back to the, you know, Romans 14 kind of conscience issues. That does seem to be Paul's main concern, is that we maintain love towards one another within the body on these issues over which Christians vehemently disagree. But Paul seems to insist that we demonstrate love towards one another and give people room. And I think we're going to have that on this issue.
Mm. Well, in vitro fertilization is taking front and center in the pro-life debate and the whole battle over the sanctity of human life. And Ed, thank you for bringing some of these arguments to light. Again, the article is titled, Should Christian Couples Use IVF? By our guest, Ed Vitagliano, in this month's The Stand magazine. Ed, good to have you with us today. Thank
Great
you.
Great to be with you, Jeff.
Well, next weekend, what would America's healthcare infrastructure look like under RFK Jr.'s leadership? Katie Talento, an epidemiologist and former Trump administration health advisor, will give us an inside look. If you haven't gotten your free trial subscription to The Stand magazine or signed up for our daily email update on culture, faith, and family, we encourage you to do that. Visit afa.net/thestand. And today's guest information is on our podcast page at afr.net. Thanks for listening, and join us next time on The Stand Radio.